And welcome to Backstage Pass, a spinoff of the Rock and Roll Survivors podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. I'm Kristen, and I'll be talking with music writers, podcasters, photographers, promoters, groupies, and so many others who love rock and roll. So here's your Backstage Pass. Let's get started. Welcome back, Madeline Beccaro, to the second interview series of having you back to Backstage Pass and your incredible book called In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. It is an extraordinary biography. I have said this before, but it bears repeating. It is so well historically researched, but it is so approachable in reading it. There are fantastic anecdotes. You bring in all the cast of characters we know. And we've been talking about getting to know Yoko Ono from a different lens, as opposed to with John Lennon. I really want to talk about her art. And on the last episode, you picked some of your favorite pieces, having known her for decades and loved her for decades. And so on this episode, I want to have you pick up on now talking about her as a composer, as a musician, as a vocalist, as a songstress, where she is approaching music and as an artist and why, and understanding that her art as a conceptual artist, I believe, cannot really be separated from her art as a musician. So welcome back, Madeline. I'm so thrilled you're here.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm feeling at home here now. It's great.
It's wonderful. Well, my attitude is we could talk about your book forever, but the goal is for everybody to experience your book on their own, because I was thinking about it. People talk about listening to songs, right? And that one song can take on 1,000 different meanings for 1,000 different listeners. And that's what I think your book offers. It is very much a companion piece for people, and they need to appreciate this themselves through their own lens. So I can't wait to hear what music pieces you've picked of Yoko Ono. So please begin.
Okay, so Yoko wasn't probably ever going to do much music, I don't think. You know, she did some things with John Cage, as we said in the last episode, who was more interested in sound and the reactions people could get from sound. There was a piece she did called Audience Piece, and her colleagues stood on the stage with their backs to the audience silently and just, you know, had the audience sitting there expecting something and just watching and getting angrier and angrier and finally leaving. And she once said, you know, it was a successful concert if the audience all got up and left. You know, that was her attitude. So, she ended up going to Paris, being invited by Ornette Coleman, the jazz great, to do a performance with him, Royal Albert Hall.
How did that connection even come about?
You know, I'm not even sure. I mean, her, her assistant or close friend who kind of did some work for her arranged it all once she told him to. So he might have had a connection there. He was doing this performance, and the rehearsal was recorded. And that's the track called Aus, A-O-S, on her first album. It's the first track on her very first record that John put on there. And it was a total improvisational piece. It was called Emotional Modulation. And it was really an instruction that she wrote to these band members. So, you know, it was in 1968, and she instructed Ornette and the musicians, think of the days when you had to suffer in silence for 10 days of eternity before you could give, and yet you were afraid of giving, because what you were giving was so true and so total, you knew that you would suffer a death after that. Think of the days when you allowed silences in your life for dreaming. This is no shit, no mood, or whatever you call it. It's real. Forget about what you've learned or heard in the music academy world. So it, even though it's an instruction for a piece, it's basically her motivational, a mission statement, you know?
It's a mission statement, but it's also a guide for musicians and for artists.
Yeah.
To say, get out of what you thought you knew, you know, and I love that she's saying that to Ornette Coleman, who's an incredible.
And his Charlie Hayden, all these, classic jazz people who've been playing for years and were renowned. So this is the beauty of it, you know?
Well, that goes back to her idea of integrity, but also I was reading in your book, and I've read this before about her, that when asked who does she admire, you know, whether, yes, it was John Lennon, of course, but it's herself.
I admire many people. She's really working in a vacuum. When she was growing up, she didn't have a turntable and posters on her walls. It was 1933 she was born. So by the mid 40s, she's only 15, you know? Mm-hmm. What didn't exist?
Well, not only did rock and roll not exist, but you were saying this in a previous episode, that she wanted to be a composer, but right. She in that time was told there are no female composers.
Her own father told her there are no female composers. Like, what, are you crazy?
So before we go on to the next music piece, how did her mission statement to these jazz greats go over?
They played it and you'll hear it on the record. It's interesting, very interesting.
Yeah. I love that. I love that she has that strength in her, that inner strength, even if it's conditioned around her trauma, she found that inner strength.
There's something in her that knows she's right. And also, she's right because her intentions are pure and good. So she doesn't question them.
That's fantastic. And that's also such a simple way of approaching life. You don't have to worry if that's your outlook.
Mm-hmm.
There's no manipulation going on. There's no hidden agenda.
No. And what people are chattering away and saying bad things about you, of course, it hurt her and she was upset, but she couldn't. It was just so ridiculous to her. So she went on.
Well, tell us more about the music that you love of hers.
So I love it all. I mean, there's the avant-garde, the first album. She's jamming with Ringo Starr and Klaus Voormann and John. And that was, a lot of it was treated in the end with tapes and manipulation. And it has kind of an eerie, ethereal quality to it. And recently the sessions came out, the raw sessions from that time. And you can hear that it's just a bunch of rocking out, but you can tell how much she gave to it later on by enhancing it. So it's really a cool comparison. And Sean says about that album, you know, she comes from not even knowing much about rock and roll to inventing punk rock, because some of that stuff is really wild. And then her second album was a double called Fly, and it has a lot of avant-garde pieces on it, some really strange percussion on there. A lot of instruments were created by this guy, Joe Jones, who had a music company called the Tone Deaf Music Company. He built all these wind instruments and percussive instruments for her, and they lend such a wild atmosphere, really cool stuff. And a lot of that is in the soundtrack to the Imagine film. And there's, on that album is Mrs. Lennon, her ballad about being the wife of John. And it's a very strange thing, being called Mrs. Lennon when she was really her own person. And it has the track called Fly, which is the soundtrack to her film of the same name, with the fly crawling across the woman's body. So that album is one of my favorites as well. It has Mind Train, which is killer live. It has Don't Worry Kyoko, which is Eric Clapton on it. You know, great, great stuff. And then following Fly was another double, Approximately Infinite Universe. And this one, oh my God, it went through so many genres. There's a reggae thing, there's rock, there's ballads. If Barbara Streisand sang some of these songs, they would have been hits, lyrically and musically, so beautiful. She had the Elephant's Memory Band on there. Stan Bronstein wailing on sax is great, great stuff. John is on there, Mick Jagger singing on that. Is Winter Here to Stay one of her greatest blues pieces? So, you know, this music is a fraction of her life. And the screaming in the music is a fraction of her life. And this is what people are focusing on. So I just try to say that there's something for everyone in her music. And if you're going to refuse to listen to it, there's so much else about her life that she's giving us that's so important.
There's two things I want to touch upon that you said. I mean, I could touch upon a lot more, but first of all, the thread of musicians that she's worked with, Ringo Starr, Eric Clapton, Mick Jagger, John Lennon, I mean, and more, Ornette Coleman, I mean, right? I mean, Charlie Hayden, these people who, whether, and earlier, Pete Townsend was inspired by her art, and that's why he started destroying his guitars. You can read about that in your book as well. But the thing is, how did this echo chamber then happen with outside listeners to just, I mean, for lack of a better way of putting it, hate her and still continue to blame her when all of their artists that they admired and revered got her?
They didn't want to listen. They still don't. I think part of it is that I think what a lot of the girls think is that, you know, he left his wife and child. He committed adultery. There is this blonde wife ideal. And they grew up with John in the 60s as being married to this Cynthia, who was a beautiful person all around, very sweet, never said a bad word about John, even though he treated her pretty badly in the end. They did have a deep love story in the beginning, but John grew out of that and he met Yoko. And even Cynthia had said, you know, when I first saw them together, there was this aura that could not be denied. Like, she even felt it. So people are used to this family unit that he had at the time, and he broke that up suddenly, and they were appalled, and they still are. So I think that's part of it.
I've said this before, and you don't have to say it, but I will, that I think there's also something to the, we've said this before, the anti-Japanese sentiment, the fact that she's seen as the other, the fact that she's doing this kind of heady cerebral art to some who don't understand it. She's very much an anomaly to these people who would view a blonde white housewife with a child. She would be seen as an outsider. And it's justification to blame someone. And I think that's what's so frustrating even to this day. It's like, please, please let it go. And I don't at all want to focus on the negative, because you and I did talk about this before. But for those people who still want to hold on to the fact that she can't sing, or it's atonal, or she's screaming, just if you can recap for people what the screaming means. And I want to say that ever since you told me this one part of it is, I believe you said Yoko Ono said, why is it okay for the Concorde airplane to screech over our heads? Not only screech with the noise, but dropping a lot of gasoline onto our nature and ruining a lot of our land. But why is that noise okay, but a woman screaming, whether in childbirth or not, is considered offensive? So I'd love your take on it.
Right. Well, she's saying that they just want to hear a woman say, hear a woman singing a pretty song. That's what men want. They want you to be quiet and demure and whatever. But when she was a young child and she heard the sounds of childbirth, and especially in Japan, women or anyone wasn't even supposed to smile in a photograph. It was just a very repressive society. So that's what the basis of it. And then she has the quote where she was talking about vocalizing with John Cage in 1971. And she said, you know, in opera, you have to carry your voice and keep it for a long time. You have to learn to stay for like 30 minutes, and you learn a way that you bring it up from your stomach. So, but why do girls have higher voices than men? I noticed that people like the Japanese emperor or Hitler or somebody who is a very highly pressured situation usually has a higher voice. And it seems like when somebody would strangle you or something and you have to make a sort of higher voice, it's like, because a woman is so suppressed in society, they have no choice but to go higher, you see, because you can't relax. Now, if you can relax your vocal cords, your voice goes lower. So here's, we have all these relaxed men in their baritones, and women are supposed to kind of just be on an even keel.
And this is why I love Yoko Ono so much and am so grateful for your book, because again, it goes back to this idea of women and being repressed and not, and always being in a kind of a heightened, scary scenario, whether even in the perfect of times growing up as a woman in this culture. And so there she is utilizing that repression and saying, what if the opposite could happen? What if we were allowed to scream and let it all out?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and the avant-garde people were giving her hell too. You'd think, okay, well, she's not at home in the rock and roll world or the world of female balladeers or anything. But here's a quote. The avant-garde guys didn't use the voice. They were all just so cool, right? And there was also this very asexual kind of atmosphere in the music. And I wanted to throw blood. So they were like, you know, not into that either. So she was stuck in the middle. And she said, the reason I was doing the howling was friends of mine were doing electronic music. I wanted to bring back the human thing.
See, and again, she's always thinking this. This is not, there is a point to it. And one of the themes in your book that I love so much, but I think it's a theme that you've picked up on with her is, and we talked about this before, is the idea of her work with grapefruit. You know, everything's a bit of a hybrid. And she's even doing a hybrid within music and within cultures in music, mm-hmm. and also within ideas of what it means within gender. I mean, you know, with the asexual idea within the Fluxus movement, which was the art movement that she was involved with, she kind of fit in, but she kind of didn't. She was a hybrid. And then when she was cast into the feminist art movement, she was seen as a hybrid because, yes, she was a feminist, but she was promoting heterosexual relationships, which mm-hmm. at the time was seen as taboo. But mm-hmm. I almost think I don't want to put words into her mouth, but I think, as you said, she said there's a part of her that's always right. So I bet she might have, I don't want to say bet, I hope she relished being that hybrid and knowing how unique and different she is.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a quote. She's like, I wasn't valued by people, or if they did value me, it was in a particular way. So I started to feel that if no one else loved me, then I had to love myself. I would think, darling, you know, you work so hard. You're always trying to do good, but somehow it's not being appreciated. I feel sorry for you. That's what I was thinking at the time. And I kind of like myself for being that one who survived regardless. There are two sides of the coin. One side is saying, poor darling. And then the other side is saying, hey, you know, you're right. So she knew she was right.
She knew she was right, but I also feel that's such a healthy approach. She didn't go complete ego. You know, and she also didn't completely become an introvert and insider and have her voice silenced. And so I think this is a perfect way to end our second episode here, because I want to pick up on this inner strength and this vision of how she approaches her art, her music, and life even, or her inner voice or her mind, I think stems from her love of nature, her childhood in nature, her ideas of Buddhism, and so many other aspects of the spirit realm coming into her ideas. Nice. And so before we get there, please plug your incredible book, In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono, and tell us where we can find it and then about your writing blog.
Okay, so you can find it at conceptualbooks.com. There is the option of having the hardcover or the soft cover there, and it can be signed by me if you choose. And also it's on Amazon for those overseas for free shipping. It's at conceptualbooks.bookbaby.com or booksbaby.conceptualbooks.com. I keep getting that confused. And it's in independent bookstores have it usually. Bigger stores, you can order it if it's not in there. Just order it by name. And yeah, it's around. And also, I think it's on Target website. Some of the big name stores have it on the websites. But my music blog is madelinex.com. And that there you can find my writings about all the music I loved growing up from the 70s to the 80s, all the musicians I've met and interviewed and spoke with and befriended and all that kind of passionate, wonderful stuff.
Well, I can't wait to have you back for the next episode, but I will say this, you have self-published this book. So even though it's now available at all of these names that everybody knows, I want to encourage everybody to please pick up a copy of this book to support this incredible artist. And I mean you, Madelin Beccaro, and your incredible work. So I can't wait to talk more about your biography on Yoko Ono. So until then.